Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Scarlet Leadership Monthly Conference Call. My name is Tom Parrish, and if you'd like a copy of today's slides, send me an email at tom@scarletleadership.com, and I'll get those off to you after our phone call. So without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to the world-famous Joe Scarlet.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to our the first call for 2015. We're glad to have you with us. Hope everybody had a happy new year. We're beginning a new series this month. We're going to have a CEO with us each of the next several months, and we're going to talk about leadership from the CEO's perspective. Now, our next call will be February 11th, and we haven't decided on a CEO yet, but we have a number of them in the bullpen, and we'll have a good one for us on February 11th. So with that, I want to turn it over to our hostess, Mary Fink. Mary?
Thanks, Joe, and thank you, John, for being with us. John Sarasulo is with us. He's CEO and president of ADS Securities and has been with us for a number of panel discussions, which have all been fascinating and interesting, and has a lot to share about leadership. He's done a lot of things in leadership and is now, as I said, running ADS Securities. So, John, we just want to have a conversation about your leadership philosophy, kind of where you come from, what lessons you've learned, what stories you have to tell. Everybody has a story.
That is the truth. Well, it's a pleasure to be here and a great honor to be to have a chance to share some thoughts with everyone today, and especially to be in a room with you guys, which is always fun to do.
Yes, it is always fun to be here with everybody. Tell us a little bit about your experience and history. Let's get that kind of out of the way and set as a foundation.
Sure. So I grew up in New York and joined the Navy right out of high school. I went to the Naval Academy, and that was a great leadership laboratory, if you will, a bunch of 18 to 22-year-old kids that really didn't know anything about anything coming together and presented with some really interesting challenges to try to develop leadership skills. The whole curriculum is really built around the development of leadership skills, and anyone on the call who has spent any time in the military probably knows that in the military you get exposed to the best of both ends of the spectrum, really outstanding leaders and also some really bad ones. And of course you can learn from both. Sometimes you learn more from the bad ones than you do from the good ones. When I graduated from the Naval Academy, I spent the next 5 years as an engineer in the Navy, spent most of that time on a ship. Another, I think, really great opportunity to learn leadership. There's something about being presented with the kind of day-to-day challenges that you're faced with in a military unit that really, I think, just accelerates the leadership education. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. I left the Navy in 1988, and my first job in the corporate world was with Michelin Tire Corporation. I was an engineer in a tire factory, did that for a couple of years, and then joined a unit of Alcoa, the aluminum company Alcoa. They had a telecommunications division. It was a joint venture with a Japanese company, and I spent 17 years with them in various roles in both manufacturing and in a service business. And then in 2008, I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to join ADS Security, headquartered here in Nashville, as president, and became CEO a couple of years ago. We have about 300 employees in ADS and 16 branches across the Southeast, which presents some really interesting leadership challenges. So that's my experience kind of business side, but in addition to that, pertinent to our discussion about leadership, I've also had the chance to have leadership roles in some nonprofits, which have been a really very valuable experience for me. I'm on the board of advisors of a group called the Atlas Network, which does work around the world supporting groups fighting for liberty in various challenging places around the world, and I'm also the chairman of the board of the Beacon Center of Tennessee. Beacon Center is a state-based free market think tank headquartered here in Nashville.
Excellent. So a lot of different experiences. And one thing that I can think of as a challenge on a ship for a long time, very tight quarters. So I would think some of the interpersonal things would come into play, and some of those skills would probably be highly honed, finely honed, as you spent your years on the sea.
Yeah, there's nothing like being out at sea with, in my case, it was 600 friends for, in some cases, 6 months at a time. You really learn, unlike a job, it's not 8 hours and then you go home and you have a separate part of your family life. You're with these folks 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you really get to know the best and the worst about people. And it really presents some very interesting and unique challenges in terms of leadership, because you have to kind of approach those situations a little bit different than you might approach a situation where your only interface with someone is in a business environment, because there you really are, in some cases, like a family. So you have some kind of family dynamics that, as everybody knows, can be the hardest leadership challenges to deal
with
sometimes.
So what was the biggest lesson you learned there?
Oh, boy. So there was, probably the biggest lesson I learned there was the ability to, and I didn't do this well at first, but the ability to learn to deal with failure, and to deal with situations that don't, because the challenges that you face are in some cases, obviously life and death when you're on a ship out at sea in difficult conditions, and things are always changing, things always don't go well, and probably the biggest lesson I took away from that was how important it is to be able to maintain your composure in difficult situations, and not let your emotions dictate your behaviors. And I was fortunate enough to have an amazing captain of our ship, who was just totally unflappable. No matter what happened, no matter how bad the situation got, he never changed his demeanor. And it was really instructive to see the way his behavior in that regard improved the performance of everyone around him. Because when things went bad and everybody looked at the captain and he was calm and cool and collected, it kind of settled everybody else down, and everybody else was then able to get control of their own personal situation and make better decisions. So it wasn't just that he was calm and made good decisions. He was calm and cool through those situations, and it allowed everybody else to kind of lower the temperature a little bit so that they independently would make their own better decisions. And I saw that time and time again, and I've seen many times in my own career where just that thing happens, and something's going wrong, and everybody turns their head and looks at the one guy or gal in the room that they're taking their lead from. And if that happens to be you, and you don't handle that well, you can end up putting everybody else in a situation where they're so emotional about it, they're unable to make good decisions.
Exactly. What a great opportunity for you to learn from someone. A lot of times, it is what we're looking for in a terrible situation, for somebody that can keep their calm and keep their wits about them. Even if they're not making the decisions,
right,
they're putting that calm on the water,
mm-hmm,
so it makes it easier for us to do what we need to do.
Yeah, and in fact, and that's a good example, too. I think from a leadership standpoint, I give him a lot of credit, because there were probably plenty of times where he could have jumped in and told everybody what to do. No doubt he knew. Mm-hmm. But he didn't do that unless it really called for that kind of an emergency decision. He had a good enough grasp of the situation where he was able to sit back and let the folks around him practice and hone their skills by dealing with those situations. Because too often leaders are so good at making decisions, that's generally why they get to be in leadership positions, that it's hard to hold yourself back when you know the right answer. And often that's the right thing to do, because if you don't, you end up developing a team around you that every time something goes wrong, they look to you, and the one time you're not there, they don't know what to do.
That's right. They don't develop.
Yeah.
I was fortunate to have a mentor in the same regard. When I was young and impulsive, my predecessor, Tom Hennessy, who was much older and much more calm, he would be the calming influence which would impact all of us in terms of, well, let's just think this out before we do anything panicky.
Exactly. So given all the experience that you've had and the different opportunities that you've had, what's the thing you like most about being a leader? Is it getting up every morning and being in charge?
Is it? Yeah, I think you got to watch out for someone who says, I like being a leader because I want to be in charge. You know, that's an interesting question. It's a natural human desire, I think, to want to achieve great things, to want to enjoy success, and to want to be on a winning team. And to me, that's kind of the root of leadership. And I view everybody, and I think most of you would probably agree with me, everyone is a leader in one regard or another. So the world is not split between leaders and followers. Everybody is a leader in some capacity, and everybody is a follower in some capacity. And I think of that in terms of a baseball team. You know, when you look at a baseball team, the manager is a leader in a certain respect, right? He's going to make the decisions about whether the batter should bunt, whether the runner should steal a base. The manager is making some of those decisions and providing leadership. The captain on the field is also providing some leadership, right? So one of the players is the captain of the team, and they're providing some leadership. But really, when you think about it, every player on that team is a leader in ways that are in some cases visible, but in many cases leading by example. We have a phrase that we use at ADS. We talk about leaders in the middle and the importance of folks in an organization who might not be in a senior leadership role, but are the people that everyone in the company looks to and kind of takes a cue from their example that they set. So I think, kind of back to the question of what I like most, everybody wants to succeed. Everybody wants to be on a winning team. Everybody on that team is a leader in one regard or another. And what I think I enjoy most about it is just the joy, the personal joy from that I get from being on a winning team and achieving success, the inspiration that comes from helping others to achieve things that they might not have thought possible that they could achieve, and finally probably the satisfaction that comes from helping people develop their own careers and their own skills.
Exactly.
and do good things personally themselves.
Exactly, and I love your idea of leading from the middle. In fact, I wrote that down because I think that's a great concept. I have two clients right now that are trying to inspire people to lead wherever they are, and one of them actually wants to call the session lead from anywhere,
mm-hmm.
Because she wants them, in this particular case, to demonstrate leadership skills wherever they are, whatever they're best at, share that with somebody else, do it the best that you can, and who knows where it will go.
Yeah.
You may never be, you know, the department head or a manager, mm-hmm. but you're always going to be the best at that. So I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
It's a great concept. What are your greatest challenges? What makes you not want to get up in the morning so much and go in?
Greatest challenge. So there's a couple of things, personally, things that I find challenging that I have to work to overcome. I think the first is one of the things I mentioned earlier about dealing with setbacks. I'm a very optimistic person by nature, very aggressive, and it's really, really hard when you're used to success to dealing with setbacks. And I can think of a couple of examples. One, when I was back in the Navy, I was in charge of the engineering plant during a certain evolution, and I did something that was clearly wrong and not well thought out. And the result was a situation, without going into too much details, where someone could have gotten seriously injured, and thank goodness nobody did. But it clearly was a case where I put people's lives in jeopardy and their well-being in jeopardy. And I was very successful in my time in the Navy, and I was very proud of what I did, and it was really, really hard to deal with the fact that I really screwed up in a pretty significant way. And again, I was surrounded by folks like the captain I mentioned earlier that helped me to learn from that experience, but it was really, it bothers me to this day. In fact, I talked to my son about it a number of times. He's in the Navy now, and it still is something that kind of stays with me. I'm glad that I learned from it, but it was really a difficult thing to kind of deal with the fact that I made such a significant mistake. And then from a business standpoint, all of us as leaders are involved in leading projects and teams. And one of the things that I struggle with is when things aren't going well, there's a time where a good leader pushes through challenges that he confronts, and then there's a time where a leader decides, I've got enough information to know I need to change my direction. And that's a really difficult thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
My tendency is to want to push through and be successful just for the fact that I don't want to ever fail.
Finish what you started.
Yeah, I started this. We thought it was a good idea, and we're going to get it done. And it's hard to discern which of those two situations you're in, right? When you're in the middle of it, you know, is this a situation where I need to just push through and not let this obstacle get in my way? Or is this a situation where somebody's trying to tell me something and I really need to change direction? And I had one example early in my career when I was in manufacturing. We were working on transitioning to some what at the time were called Japanese manufacturing techniques. I was with a company that was part Japanese owned, but today it's probably called lean manufacturing or things along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a huge amount of resistance because it was a significant change to try to take an organization that was very traditional in their approach to manufacturing and to adopt some of these new ideas. And it would have been very, very easy to give up on that effort and just say it can't be done. In fact, the best thing to do in that case is what we did. We pushed through and overcame that resistance. In the long run, that was the right thing. But I had an experience recently in my career where we had essentially had a division of our company that was not succeeding. And we tried way too hard and way too long to turn it around.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up eventually divesting that unit. But it was a painful decision to make because it was akin to admitting failure and
mm-hmm.
admitting that the decision to start that unit, that division was wrong, that all the effort and time and blood and sweat and tears that people had put into trying to turn it around was going to be wasted. And it really took a few folks around me to pull me aside and say, John, you really need to think about this. This is probably the time to do something. So I find those kind of decisions really difficult. And I recently had someone, actually this is just 2 days ago, someone told me a quote that really stuck with me. And the quote is, one of the biggest time wasters is trying to improve something you shouldn't even be doing.
Wow.
Which was really profound.
Wow.
And as soon as I heard that, I thought back to that situation. And we had put a lot of effort and resources into fixing something that we really should not have been doing. But again, when you're in the middle, it's really, really hard to know which of those two paths
right.
is right.
Exactly.
Am I giving up too easy if I stop at this obstacle, or is it something that I really need to stop doing?
Yeah, I want to follow up with you on that and ask you, did you ask for advice? Did you seek advice from those people that came to you, or did they just come to you and say, you know, John?
So that's a great question that I think gets us to a very, very, very important leadership topic, and that is surrounding yourself with people that are willing to challenge you. And I'm fortunate, my CFO at our company is a good friend, and he's a great guy, but he is not shy at all about telling me I'm screwing up. And the lesson there is make sure you never put yourself in a situation where everybody around you agrees with everything you say and do,
right.
because if that's the case, you are on your way to a major, major disaster.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Deep trouble.
If you have a yes person on your team, one of you is unnecessary.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Those are the most valuable people you can have are those people that will come to you and say, you know what? We need to talk.
So I think a couple things at that point. Number one is, so you got to think about that when you're hiring and promoting, right? So that's important consideration when you put somebody in a leadership role. But just as importantly, you as a leader have to make sure those folks around you know that you want that. Even if your body language says you don't want to hear it, even if some of the words you say make it sound like you don't want to hear it, you have to appreciate and reward folks that are willing to go out on that ledge for you.
And once they come and tell you the truth that you don't want to hear, you need to say thank you.
That's right. First word.
Not argue with them.
That is a really, really hard thing to do, because the first thing you want to say is, let me explain to you what you don't understand and why I'm right about this.
Exactly. So what do you do with those folks? How do you show them? I mean, how do you have a mindset? Do you have to talk to yourself and say, this is information I need to hear?
Yeah.
How do you get there?
So, for me, this is not something I think I did well much through my career, although I've learned these lessons. In fact, Joe has helped me learn some of these here recently. So this fellow that I just mentioned, our CFO, I have had many conversations with him, and certainly every review I do, but many conversations in between reviews where I tell him how valuable he is to me because he provides me that kind of counsel. And I want to reinforce that with him every chance I get, and I want to encourage him to help me because some of the other folks on your team are not going to be as willing to do that, right? It takes a certain amount of guts,
courage. It's risky.
Especially if you're not sure it's going to be received really well. But you know, my goal is not just to have folks around me that are willing to say that to me, but the rest of my team needs to surround themselves with folks in their circles
exactly.
that are willing to do the same thing. So,
exactly.
I think the best thing to do is talk about it. I think what Joe said is absolutely right. People need to know the first thing you say to someone who gives you news that you are not really expecting and maybe didn't want to hear is thank you, whether you believe it or agree with it. No matter where in the organization it comes from, you got to let them know the fact that they said it is something that you appreciate. And I think if you can build that in your culture, what it does is it prevents – I think a culture that has folks with that kind of attitude – You won't find them having major, major disasters because they're going to make mistakes, but they're going to correct those mistakes more quickly as opposed to a CEO who has a bunch of yes men around him.
Believes his own press,
and then that's the guy who's going to be on the cover of Fortune 1 week, and the next week is going to be, you know.
Maybe on the cover again,
maybe,
but for a different reason.
Right. Yeah.
Excellent. So was that the toughest decision then that you've had to make?
Dealing with those setbacks and those challenges is probably one. Another one that I would say, and this is another one that I've learned probably later in my career than I wish I had, is to never be afraid to take unpopular positions. And it's very easy as a leader sometimes to be more concerned about being liked and admired than it is being trusted and respected. And I think the problem there for a lot of leaders is, and this again is something I learned in the Navy, is leaders have to face reality as it is, not as they wish it was. And too many people conduct themselves in a framework of I wish things were this way and I'm going to act in that way, instead of stepping back and saying, you know what, I gotta receive these facts.
I gotta look this in the face.
Yeah, I got information coming at me that I've got to really hear and understand and think about, and not just assume that I'm right and all this feedback coming back to me is wrong. We had a situation in my previous company. We were very rapidly growing business, and the market was booming, and all of a sudden, I was in the telecom industry. All of a sudden, there was some real indications that there was going to be a major, major slowdown. This was at the time when telecom companies were investing a lot in fiber optic networks around the country, and there was a huge amount of investment. And it was not, maybe not a bubble, but it was an overinvestment that was bound for a correction. And we started seeing little signs of it, but it was really easy to convince yourself, if you weren't careful, that, well, now, you know, we're still on the right trajectory. Things are still going to be fine. Our projections are still going to work out. When the right answer, and the one that we came to, I think, pretty quickly, was the landscape was changing and it was time to readjust the business. We ended up having to consolidate some divisions we had. We had a number of joint venture partners, and the only way that we could consolidate was to buy out some of our partners so that we could do a pretty aggressive consolidation and restructuring. And we moved really quickly and took some very, at the time, unpopular decisions about buying out some of these partners, spending a good bit of money, but then positioning the business for the downturn that was coming.
And I think the big lesson there was never avoid reality. Things are as they are, not as you wish they would be, and the sooner you face up to that, the more likely you're going to make decisions that are going to position your business for success.
Exactly. If someone has recently shared with us that hope is not a strategy.
That's right. Exactly right.
So wishing it isn't going to make it so, for sure. Share with us some of your leadership lessons. That's one of them.
So, you know, it's interesting, all these experiences are lessons, right? I mean,
exactly.
If you're going to be a student of anything, and we all should be students of leadership, if everybody on this call, I'm sure, is, every experience you have is an opportunity to learn. So there probably are a couple that stand out. One is the one I just mentioned about earning. It's more important to earn the trust and respect of the people around you than their friendship. And that doesn't mean you can't be friends with the people that you work with. That was a challenging one for me because my nature is such that I really enjoy getting close with the folks I work with and building strong teams. But you can never forget when you're in a leadership role that you're going to be called on at some point to make difficult, unpopular decisions. And you have to be able to do that. And the way to do that is to make sure you have the trust and respect of your team and not behave in a way that that your goal is to make friends as opposed to succeed. I think the second big picture lesson, and like a lot of these things I've talked about, for me, a lot of this goes back to the Navy, is good leaders have extraordinarily high expectations for themselves and for their teams. I never cease to be amazed at how people are able to accomplish things that are far beyond what they thought and many times what you might think they can accomplish. But if you set ridiculously challenging objectives for folks and you're willing to behave in a way that kind of models the behaviors that would achieve those objectives, it's just amazing what folks can accomplish. They're really, I think everybody gets used to thinking about kind of the average person and the average team and the average business and the average division and the average company and how they're doing. But, you know, the goal of a business leader should not be to be an average division.
Anything.
Or an average company. Yeah. You want to be an outlier. You want to be one of those companies that folks are studying to figure out how you did it.
Right.
And the way you do that is by setting standards that people almost, you know, blink their eyes when you tell them this is what I'm expecting of you. You want them to have that kind of reaction. That can't be done. Well, maybe it can be done. Let's talk about it. How would you behave if you had to accomplish that objective? And I think the higher the standards you set for your people and obviously for yourself, the better opportunity you have to really surprise folks with some results that are outside of what folks would have thought might otherwise have been possible.
Mm-hmm. You're right. As you said, we have a lot of leaders and prospective leaders and up-and-coming leaders on our call. What advice do you have for them, other than to do these things that you have learned, sharing your lessons, but what would you pass on?
Yeah, so there's you often learn most from the things that you don't do well. So a number of these are things I did not do well early in my career that I've really learned from. So I think first, this is one that I've really only recently learned, probably just in the last 5 or 6 years, and that is how critically important it is to surround yourself with awesome, amazing people in everything that you do. So it certainly goes for work. So you want to surround yourself to the degree that you have the opportunity and the control over that, to surround yourself with people that are just unusually outstanding. But it's not only in your business career; it's in your personal life too. I mean, every hour you spend with a boring person that you have nothing to learn from is an hour wasted.
Exactly.
Spend that time with someone who is unusual and interesting and exciting, and you can learn so much by being purposeful about who you spend your time with.
Absolutely. I think we've all learned that lesson at some point in our life. Those people that lift you up,
yeah,
as opposed to those people that just, as you said, bore you or
yeah,
maybe even bring you down.
Yeah, well, even, yeah, that's right. Sure.
You see that name on your phone and you go, oh, no.
Yeah. But, you know, I think the important point about that is being purposeful about it. So, you know, I'm pretty big on setting objectives at the beginning of the year for myself. And for many years, you know, one of my objectives was to meet blank number of amazing people that I didn't know before. And sometimes I'll even make a list of, you know, folks I might read about in the Business Journal or somewhere that I think, man, this is a really bright, interesting person. And I probably will never just bump into them or get introduced to them, but I need to find a way to meet them.
That's right. Make it my business.
So how can I do that? Let me find out what they're interested in, where they hang out, what they do, who they know on LinkedIn. There's ways to do it.
Exactly. And Joe is a master at it. I'm always amazed at the number of people and who it is that he knows because he just reached out.
When I think about how I've learned things over the last several decades, I've learned more through networking than any other single way. And the more people you get to know, the more you get to learn it, and the more different types of people you meet, the more you're going to learn too. It's like reading a book. If you keep reading what the same author wrote over and over again, you're not learning so much, just switch to a different author. So the more different people you get to meet, the more opportunities you have for all kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think about Joe a lot when I mention that, because I met Joe probably 7 or 8 years ago, and, you know, I wish 10 years before that I had reached out to Joe when he was running track supply and called him up and asked him to go to lunch. I'm sure he would have taken a lunch with me. And
only if you're paying.
I would have had a few more years of learning from his counsel. So, again, that, keep in mind, that is not just professionally, but that's also personally. So even outside of business, do your best to surround yourself with folks that really are going to help you to stretch yourself and expand your mind and expand your everything about yourself.
You know, we have many of our instructors that will say the same thing. This information that I'm sharing with you is important at the workplace, but it's just as pertinent in your personal life.
Yeah.
We do have two questions. The
sure.
first one, Alan Mullally from Ford made famous his business process review weekly meeting with his senior management. Can you talk about the specific process elements you use to manage your business?
Oh, boy, that's interesting. Yeah. Let me tell you a little bit about my business now as I answer that question. So ADS Security, we provide residential and commercial security services to customers across the Southeast. Our headquarters is here in Nashville, and we have 16 branches in Florida, Georgia, South and North Carolina, Tennessee, Alabama, Kentucky, and Mississippi. And managing a network of locations like that presents some really unique challenges. The rubber meets the road with our technicians and sales folks that visit our customers in their homes and businesses. I'll say this probably a couple of times during this. This is something I really learned a lot from Joe, the importance of getting out and not being a creature of corporate. So our business is in the field, and that's where I try to spend as much of my time as I can. So we have some regular meetings in our corporate office where we're dealing with corporate issues. But I consider, from a business process standpoint, my role and the time that I spend needs to be out where the rubber meets the road, meeting the folks that are delivering those services to our customers. So when I get out to visit branches, what I like to do is spend time in the field with our technicians. So I'll typically go out and spend a morning or an afternoon with a technician. Generally, I wear the uniform. Not generally, I'll wear the uniform of the technicians, and I'll tell the technician to introduce me as a helper who's there to help out. And it gives me an opportunity to really kind of get a better sense of that customer interface and the extraordinary talent of our people. That's one thing I always come home with every time I do that. I'm just amazed at how great our people are. And so I always want to do that, to never lose that kind of contact with our customers and employees. And then generally I'll do a business review with the leadership in the office and just kind of have a chance to uh, get an update on what's going on in the office. From a kind of general standpoint, with each employee, I do two meetings a year, one at the beginning of the year and one at the middle of the year. At the beginning of the year, I meet with every employee. It takes me about 3 weeks to get around to every location. And I talk about the results of the previous year and our plans for the current year. And then in the middle of the year, it's kind of a mid-course guidance. How are we doing? Are we on track? Are we off track? So that at least every employee gets a chance to hear from me that information and kind of reinforcing our mission and the values of the company. That's probably the best I can describe from a process standpoint.
But that really is more of a face-to-face interactive with the folks rather than a corporate process.
Yeah, when I first started doing those meetings, I had a 60-slide presentation with charts and graphs, and I got some great feedback from my employees who are not shy about telling me when I'm doing something stupid. And now it's now way fewer slides, not nearly hardly any charts and graphs, and a few numbers just when we talk about the results and the objectives, but more a discussion about here's what's going on, here's how we're going to win, and it's I get really good feedback from the employees. I think they really enjoy the opportunity to have the chance to connect with me on that level twice a year.
And I think that's probably rare for a CEO to do.
Well, and again, I learned this from Joe when we first met, and Joe told me about how, because the problem I always had was I seemed like I could never find the time to do it. I always had so much stuff going on, and Joe told me something pretty obvious. Well, at the beginning of the year, pull your calendar out and block off the weeks you're going to be out in the field, and don't schedule anything, and then you don't have to worry about it.
Okay, our second question. The security industry is starting to face technology change with the rise of Nest and others.
Yes.
How do you remain appropriately paranoid about new competition, as Andy Grove recommends, but manage the existing business well?
Yeah, appropriately paranoid. That's a good phrase. just very briefly, the security industry, about half our business is residential, and in the residential space, there's a whole lot of new entrants that are coming in. The questioner mentioned Nest. Nest is a company that was recently bought by Google for a lot of money. And it's kind of part of the smart home movement that a lot of companies are pouring a lot of money into.
Mm-hmm.
And we play in that area. So when we install a security system, we can install a thermostat that you can adjust from your phone and lights that you can turn on and off and door locks that you can open and close and all sorts of things like that that are kind of competing with companies like Nest. When you get a sense that Google is moving into your market, that's not something you want to – that's a fact of reality you want to face up to. So I think appropriately paranoid is probably the right phrase. So what are we doing? The first thing we did is we sat down and we talked about what are our strengths in that market, right? For a residential customer, what is it that we deliver? What is the value that we deliver to that customer that we really, really need to focus on that separates us from what Google or somebody might be selling products at Lowe's or online or whatever. And there's a couple of things. So first and foremost, what separates us is our focus on delivering what we call legendary service to our customers. So we want to be so good at that customer interface in every aspect, whether we're in the home with the customer, whether we're on the phone with them, whether they're receiving a bill in the mail or whatever it might be. We want to be so legendary about the way we deliver service that they just can't wait to rave to their friends and family about us. In fact, we call those customers raving fans. We have a survey that we do, and we calculate what we call a raving fan index, which kind of gives us a sense of what our customers think of us. And we know if we do that well and continue to do that well, there's going to be some technological challenges that we're going to face and we're going to have to keep up with on that front. But if we do that well, that's the moat around our business that's really going to prevent at least a significant disruption. But in addition to that, we've got to do a good job of keeping up with technology. So we are, I would say, one of the leading companies in our industry with regard to adopting those new technologies, the ones I described, and lots of new video technologies and things like that also that we're involved in. But to me, the technology is secondary to that touch and that relationship with the customer. And while we know we've got to be good from a technology perspective, we can't lose sight of what really differentiates us.
Exactly. I have one more question online,
sure.
But I want to let our callers know that if you have a question, *7 to unmute yourself and to say your question to us, and we'll answer it. We're going to continue talking as long as we have time, and we have one more question online. To ask a question online, enter your question in the box and hit submit. So *7 or enter your question in the box and hit submit. So here's our next question. How do you organize, capture, and best channel the organization's energy in terms of contributing to the community? Staff and team members have different motivations, different concerns, and regional interests in charity. How do you force multiply the company and its people when contributing to the community?
Wow. All right, that's interesting.
These are great, challenging questions.
The question is, how much do you want your people to commit to the community, too? That's not always a wise investment of time and resources.
Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting. So let me get back a little bit to kind of our strategy. So we have these 16 branches in these locations across the Southeast, and from a positioning standpoint, our goal is to be the most technologically advanced, strongest local competitor in the market. So we differentiate ourselves very, very much so from the national players that compete across the entire country and that are not really parts of their community. So an important part of that is to be a part of the communities that we operate in. How do we organize our efforts in that regard? So we as a company, we pick one charity that we're going to support each year in a significant way. We contribute to a bunch of charities, but we have one kind of major charity for the last 6 years. It's been various charities that support wounded veterans, and we get lots of input from our team about that. And then we have some programs. We have some reward programs in the company where if employees help us to identify new customers, they get a cash reward, and the management team forgoes that reward, and it goes in a pot. At the end of the year, we present that check to this military charity. So I think modeling the behavior is probably one good way that you capture the energy of the team to contribute to the communities. Each of our branches also gets a small budget that they can use to get involved in local events, and of course, they focus on events that their people are motivated about. So if there's an event that a number of employees in a branch are interested in and spend time and devote their time to, it's more likely the manager in that branch is going to devote some of those funds to that. So I don't consider that a major kind of strategic effort of ours, but it is something that we do as part of the strategy of demonstrating to our customers that we're the best local company for them to partner with.
And I think we've heard from a lot of different people that as this younger generation comes into the workforce, they have a real passion for that, for service, for wanting to know, first of all, that the work that organization does is good and serves the community, but also that they have an opportunity to do that.
You know, there's actually a few other things I'll mention in that regard. One of the things that I love about our company is the leadership is not always on the front of these efforts. We have a few things that we do in Nashville that the leadership has nothing to do with. I don't get involved in. Nobody asks for my permission. Nobody in the leadership team granted permission. But we do a big gift drive for foster children and a program that supports that. Because one of our employees happened to be very actively involved in it. And so we just started doing it, and it's become a huge event for us. It's managed by a few folks in the office. You know, they get great support from the rest of the office, but it's not a leadership initiative.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something I'm doing to try to organize or capture or energize. It's just the fact they do it. We do again, nothing to do with the leadership team. We do a chili cook-off in our office every year. And it's organized and managed by our teams, a group of folks just passionate about doing it. They pick a charity every year. Everybody brings, like we did a pet shelter one year, and everybody brought in pet food and all different sorts of stuff. We invited the folks in the charity over. We had this big chili cook-off. We picked the winner. Everybody got to make their chili, and we had a contest, and we picked the winner, and then at the end of it, we presented all the stuff that we had collected to the charity. So I think that reflects some of the strength of the organization in that regard, that it's not just the
right
the leader that's deciding what to do.
And I think that's really the sign of a healthy organization, that there's that people feel they can do that when they feel strongly about something, and that people will come together around it.
Yeah.
It's great.
So you had asked about advice earlier, and
I
mentioned one item about aggressively seeking out awesome people to be around. There's a few other things that I just mentioned real briefly. One is, and again, most of these are hard-earned lessons. Don't stay in a job longer than you should. If you're not learning and expanding yourself, even if it's comfortable, even if you're making a good living,
especially if it's comfortable,
find something else to do. And I had that situation early in my career. I probably would have been well served had I moved a little bit sooner than I did. And I talk a lot to young people about career and decisions related to career. And one of the things I've really kind of learned to stress with young folks is while financial compensation is important in your decisions, especially about your first job, but in jobs early in your career, make sure that you consider the compensation that you get by being in a situation where you're going to learn a lot. And in your first job, it's probably more important, in your first few jobs, it's more important to be in a role where you're going to be exposed to things and learn some really neat stuff. That's a lot more valuable than a few dollars an hour or a few tens of thousands of dollars a year even. It's not just the location and the salary that are important parts of the compensation that you should think about. It's who's going to teach me things that are going to position me for my long-term career success. And a lot of that revolves around the person that you work for, someone who's going to take an active role in supporting you and helping you and mentoring you.
Exactly.
Don't lose sight of that when you think about your career decisions. And then finally, I think from an advice standpoint, I would encourage folks at every level, any time in your career at every level of the organization, to pursue leadership opportunities every chance you get, whether it's in the business or outside the business, because every time you do that, you will learn something. It's a commitment of time. Sometimes it's really challenging. It can be stressful. But don't miss a chance, either in a business or in a nonprofit or wherever you might find yourself, to try to seek out those leadership opportunities, because leadership, in my mind, leadership is like a muscle, and if you don't exercise it, it doesn't get stronger, it atrophies, and the more ways you can find that to exercise that muscle in the long run, the better off you'll be.
Great. All great advice. I'll ask one last question. What are you most proud of from your leadership journey so far? You're a young man.
More ahead. That's
yeah.
Right. Most proud of, the first thing that comes to mind is the success of the people that I've had the chance to work with. So I've got some folks from that I stay in touch with from every point in my career, whether it was in the Navy and in Michelin and at my previous company before ADS in the telecom industry. There's nothing more rewarding than knowing that you played some small role in helping a person achieve the greatness that was within them. That probably is first. I'm very proud of the success of the organizations I worked in. There's nothing we should all be very proud of what we've accomplished. That's nothing, certainly nothing to apologize for. And the fact that the companies and organizations that I've been with, both nonprofit organizations and for-profit businesses that I've worked for, have done really, really great things. And been, in the case of the businesses, been very profitable. And I always stress to my folks that profit is never something to apologize for. Profit is the measure of how good you're doing at satisfying your customers' needs. So we at ADS were profitable. My previous companies were profitable and successful, and that's certainly something that I'm very proud of. And I think finally I'd say I'm proud of the fact that through the challenging situations that I've had the opportunity to lead organizations and teams through, that I've been able to know the importance of integrity and never compromise on integrity to achieve what some might consider to be success. And I think that's something we all want to get to the end of our lives and think, We did the right thing, even when it was painful, even when it was difficult, even when it wasn't so convenient,
right.
even when it was embarrassing.
Turned out badly.
Yeah. You want to be able to put your head down on the pillow at night and know that you did the right thing regardless of the consequences.
Absolutely, you do. Questions? *7. What questions do you have out there? While we are waiting, I will ask you if there's just anything else you mm-hmm. want to share with us.
Yeah, so there's one thing that, again, another thing that I really learned from Joe, and mentioned this earlier, is the way that you demonstrate to your teams and organizations what your priorities are is through your actions, not your words. And an important way that you communicate those priorities to the organization is where you spend your time. And I mentioned earlier the lesson I learned from Joe about start at the beginning of the year, and I did this just a few weeks ago, and pull out your calendar and block off the days you're going to do what's most important. And for me, a big part of that is get out and visiting our branches. And I work a lot on acquisitions and visit companies. And what you do with your time is the best indication to your people of what's important to you. And if you spend your time doing small things, then people are going to think those things are your priorities. Mm-hmm. If you spend your time doing the right things, they're going to know what the priorities of the organization are. And so for me, it's working on acquisitions. It's getting out and spending time with our teams and reinforcing the culture of what the company is all about.
Right.
Well, John, I completely concur with what you're saying.
I figured you'd agree with that.
But I want to tell you that I just yesterday finished mapping out my vacation time for the year and blocking out weeks when I'll be away.
Because that's what's important for you.
Yeah, right, that's right.
Exactly.
We have another question.
We have another question. When you have made a mistake in a hire or promotion, how quickly would you act to correct it? Well, that's presumptuous.
Never
thinking
fast
that you would have made a mistake, right?
Never.
Yeah. So the answer is not fast enough. And that gets to the idea of being very thoughtful and methodical in your hiring process, because the much better thing to do than have to deal with it quickly is not have to deal with it at all. So let's start there. So first things first, don't hire folks for leadership roles that you aren't very confident are up to it. That doesn't mean you won't make mistakes, but invest the time, as much time as necessary, and sometimes it can be pretty painful when you have an important role and it's empty and you really need to fill it and it's stressing the organization, and you got a guy or a gal who you think, maybe this person can do it. We really need somebody.
Or I can teach them.
Or, yeah. That's
I can bring them along.
Yeah.
I can develop them.
They're not great, but I think I can do it. I think I can help them do it. Those are just mistakes waiting to happen. So first and foremost, don't put yourself in a position where you have to deal with a non-performing hire any more than you have to. You're never going to be able to eliminate all those, but smart hiring can help you eliminate a lot of them. And then the second part of that is you got to be, I think, back to that idea of facing up to reality. When evidence is coming at you quickly early on that someone is not fitting in, it's not necessarily the trigger to act immediately. It's a trigger to get engaged and try to help fix it. So I've had plenty of employees in my career who started in a role and kind of ran up on the rocks, but we got to it quickly and we spent some time together and we talked about it and we set goals and we got some support and maybe some additional training or whatever else might be needed. And those employees ended up being just stellar, outstanding employees. The key is stepping up to that quickly and not letting it fester. Nothing gets better. Nothing gets worse. It only gets worse with time, so you need to face up to the reality of that kind of a situation and deal with it as quickly as you possibly can.
Right. Thank you so much.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us today. Our next call will be February 11th. We'll have another stellar CEO with us. John, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. And hope you all learned a bit today, and we look forward to seeing you next month. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Mary, and bye-bye, everybody. Happy New Year.